Hello everyone, and thanks for joining us for this latest in our series of Employment Espresso Pods. I'm Christine Young, a partner in our London employment law team, and I'm pleased to be joined today by Anna Henderson, our professional support lawyer. Today we're going to be looking at some of the employment law changes that are coming into force this Saturday on 6th of April. We've already covered the changes to redundancy protection for employees taking family-related leave, and that was in our last podcast. So today we're going to cover some of the other key changes which managers need to be briefed about and which are going to need to be reflected in staff policies.
Yes, so there are quite a lot of changes in effect this April. There's the usual increases you see to tribunal compensation award limits, the changes to minimum wage rates and pay for statutory leave. And also for those employers who have irregular hours or part-year workers, there are changes to the calculation of statutory holiday, which kick in for leave years starting on or after the 1st of April. There is more on those on our blog at hsfnotes.com. But as you say, today we're going to focus on two main areas, the changes to various family leave rights. But first, perhaps the change I think likely to cause the biggest headache for employers, which is changes to the flexible work request regime. Do you agree with that view, Christine?
Yes, I think that's right. I did see some research published by Slack this morning suggesting that 55% of the UK workforce was planning on requesting flexible working hours once these new laws have come into force. Based on a survey of only 1,000 UK desk workers, but even so, even if that's a significant overestimate, it does seem to suggest that a lot of employers are going to see an increase in the number of these requests that they're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, I think that's right. And of course, this time last week, we weren't even sure the flex work changes were actually going to be coming into force on the 6th of April at all. I think a while ago, the government had been talking about bringing them into force in the summer. And in fact, so just before the last bank holiday weekend, we still didn't have various statutory instruments that are needed to bring them into force. But obviously, we should have had a little more faith in the government. Because we did get the final regulations that came out on Good Friday. And so the new regime definitely now is in place from the 6th of April and policies do need to be updated.
Good, clear. So before we get into the details of the changes, can you give us a quick reminder of what the pre-April regime is?
Of course. So at the moment, once an employee has 26 weeks of continuous service for an employer, they have a statutory right to make one flexible working request per 12-month period. So that might be a request to change working hours or days, or to change the location where they work. So for example, they might be asking to work remotely, fully remotely, or in a more hybrid way. And that change can be either permanent or a temporary change. Basically, the employee has to make a written request and it has to state that it's a statutory request for flexible working. It has to confirm what previous requests they've made. And it also has to set out what effect the employee thinks the change they've asked for will have or might have on the business and how that effect might be overcome. And then the employer has got to deal with that request in a reasonable manner. That's what the legislation says. And then notify its decision within 3 months, although it can actually agree an extension to that period with the employee. And if the employer is rejecting the request, it's got to have one of 8 specified business reasons. So they include things like the burden of additional costs or the fact that the request might have a detrimental impact on performance or on the ability to meet customer demands, or indeed that the employer has an inability to redistribute work to other staff. The other point to make is that on top of the statutory provisions, you've got a statutory code of practice, which is published by ACAS. And that's something tribunals will take into account where it's relevant. And I think particularly that's going to be the case when they're looking at, have you dealt with a request in a reasonable manner? And we are getting a revised version of that code that's been published to apply from the 6th of April. And then finally, just to touch on what the remedy is, an employee can bring a claim for breach for up to 8 weeks' pay. That's weekly pay subject to the statutory cap. So you're looking at a maximum of just over $5,500. And that would be a claim that the employer has failed to deal with a request in a reasonable manner or has failed to give its decision within the 3-month time period or has based its decision on incorrect facts or doesn't have one of the 8 permitted reasons to reject the request.
Great, thanks. So that's clear on where we are now. So how much of that is actually going to change?
Well, I think there are sort of five main changes that I would highlight. The big one, the headline change, is that this right is now becoming a day one right. So employees basically can make this request as soon as they start work. Secondly, they can now make two requests in any 12-month rolling period instead of just the one. So basically what an employer needs to do is at the date they receive a request, they need to look back 12 months, see how many previous requests have been made. And that actually, just to make the point, that actually includes any requests that were made before the 6th of April. The counter isn't sort of reset at this point. And I guess the other thing to mention here is that you can't have more than one live request at a time. So you've got, the employee's got to wait until their first request has been concluded before they can put in a second one. I think the third main change to mention is that the written request the employee has to submit no longer has to set out what effect they think their requested change will have on the business and how to deal with that. That's one of the things I think that is going to need to be reflected in staff policies, because the ACAS code, the existing and the new one, says that employers need to make clear to employees what information they've got to put into their request. So obviously that's something that's likely to need updating to reflect that change. The fourth point is that the legislation now expressly requires an employer to have consulted with the employee about the request if they are minded to refuse it before they make that decision. Until now, that's just been in the ACAS statutory code that you should consult, because it would come within sort of needing to deal with a request reasonably. So I think it is significant that that's now been shifted into the statute itself. It's now an express part of the right. And the revised ACAS code now sort of adds a bit more detail on what consultation should look like. So the code now says, points out that the purpose of the consultation is to ensure that all relevant information is understood before you make the decision. And that could, of course, include confirming whether actually this is a disabled employee looking for a reasonable adjustment. And then the meeting should obviously discuss the pros and cons of the request, should think about any practical steps that might be needed to implement it. If it's not going to be accepted, then the meeting should consider alternative arrangements that might work for both parties. And the code also specifically mentions for the first time the need to consider the possibility of a trial period to assess the feasibility of an arrangement.
And is there any change to the position on allowing companions at meetings? I think at the moment the code suggests it's good practice to allow the employee to bring a colleague.
Yeah, so it's still just good practice in the code rather than a mandatory requirement. But what has changed is that the new code suggests that employers could allow a trade union rep or official to be the companion as an alternative to a work colleague. Although I'm not sure quite how attractive that idea will be to some employers. I think the other thing actually to note is that there's quite a lot of emphasis in the revised code on the importance of keeping a written record of discussions. I mean, obviously that's a good idea anyway, in case you need evidence of what you've done. But it's interesting that the code is now sort of emphasising that. And the other thing that it does make clear is that if you are going to agree the request in full, you don't actually need to have a consultation meeting. In an earlier draft, they seem to be suggesting that you should, whereas now they say that that might be useful to sort of talk about how to implement the request, but it's not a necessity. And then finally, the fifth big change, I think, to mention, of course, is to the timing. So the time period for deciding a request is reducing from 3 months to 2 months, and that includes any appeal if you offer one. Again, it's not actually an express requirement of the procedure to offer an appeal, but it's still something that's recommended as good practice in the code, and so therefore, again, would be factored into whether you've dealt with a request reasonably, depending on the facts. And again, you can still agree an extension to the period, but if you don't manage to agree that with the employee, then obviously 2 months is quite a tight timescale.
Yes. So I think it's particularly important then that managers are clear on who's responsible for arranging the meetings and communicating the decisions, and then documenting any agreed extensions so they don't get into difficulties in terms of timing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just to say, actually, there's two things that haven't changed. So two things that stay the same. So firstly, your list of 8 permitted reasons for rejecting requests, that remains the same. But the revised code does say that you should also, as well as providing that reason, give the employee additional information that would be reasonable to help explain your decision. So that is a sort of minor change there. But the other key thing that hasn't changed at all is the remedy for breach.
Yes, and that's been the criticism of the right since it was first introduced, because it lacks the teeth in terms of the limited ability to scrutinise the employer's reasons and the low level of compensation available. But of course, the real concern for employers is often the potential for an indirect discrimination claim. Mm. So it could be on the basis of sex, age, disability or religion, and where refusal of that flexible working particularly disadvantages one of those groups, so that the employer would have to objectively justify it in order to defend the claim. And of course, those claims are already available from day one of employment, and importantly, compensation is uncapped, and that risk applies even where an employee doesn't follow the statutory request regime. So I think it's worth bearing in mind that aspect, and that the recent codification of EU law into the Equality Act in January may actually flag the potential for more indirect discrimination claims, as it now expressly allows associative indirect discrimination claims. So this will be where a group with one of the protected characteristics is put at a disadvantage, then someone without that characteristic, but who suffers substantively the same disadvantage as that group, could also bring an indirect discrimination claim. So, for example, that might allow a man to bring a claim based on women being disadvantaged by a policy requiring full-time work. It was already the law pursuant to the EU case law, but now it's expressly written into the Equality Act. So may well encourage more of these types of claim. And of course, an increase in claims is also likely where an employer starts to pull back from a hybrid working policy, which may have been put in place during the pandemic, and encourage more days working in the office. There's a recent case against the FCA claiming that a refusal of a manager's request to work entirely from home was based on incorrect facts, where the tribunal rejected the claim on the basis that the particular role would be performed better in person, given the limitations on the technology. And that's covered in detail in our blog, if that's something of interest. So just a couple of other thoughts then. As you said, the statutory right only applies from day one, so not before someone's recruited. Although, of course, job applicants can, at least in theory, bring discrimination claims. So it would be prudent, at the very least, to make it clear that a request can be made on appointment.
Yes, I think that's right. And I guess it's also worth noting on the issue of recruits is that there's been calls from various bodies in recent years to actually introduce a new requirement on employers to include what flexible work options there are for a particular role in the job advert themselves. It's not something that this government has taken up, but I think it's something that we might well see happening under a future Labour government if we get one. So that might be a future change to watch out for. So now we're just going to touch very briefly on the other changes in relation to family leave, which hopefully won't provide quite so many challenges for employers. So the first is unpaid carer's leave. It's a completely new right, and again, it's a day one right available from the first point of employment. And it's a right to up to 1 week's unpaid leave per rolling 12 months to provide or make arrangements for the care of your dependents with long-term care needs. So employees only get 1 week, however many dependents they might be caring for. But they can take it either in single half or full days or all together. And there are various rules around what notice they have to give and how an employer can postpone a request and in what circumstances. So I do think it would be useful for employers to have a policy to set these out. And obviously, you'll also need to alert managers to the fact that there is this new entitlement.
And doesn't long-term care need to be defined?
So long-term care need is defined in the statute as long-term illness or injury likely to require care for more than 3 months, or disability as defined by the Equality Act, or issues related to old age. The legislation doesn't expressly cover terminal illness that's likely to require care for less than 3 months, Which is something that was mooted at an earlier point of the legislation going through. But I think obviously employers might want to extend the right to this situation. There's nothing to prevent them from being more generous with the entitlement. And obviously it's the kind of situation where you might want to allow somebody to take carer's leave, particularly if you if the leave has been unpaid. Again, obviously that's another area where some employers may wish to be more generous and actually pay during the leave. And the second change that I just wanted to touch on was the minor changes that there have been to paternity leave and pay rights. So again, paternity leave policies will already be in place, but they're going to need updating to reflect the fact that employed fathers and partners of children whose expected week of childbirth or date of placement for adoption is after the 6th of April, they will now be able to take their paternity leave entitlement as two separate weeks at any time in the first year from birth or placement. So prior to the 6th of April, you get one block of leave. You have to decide whether you're going to take it as 1 or 2 weeks, but you could only have one block and you had to take it within 56 days of the birth or placement. So obviously that's added in a bit more flexibility for fathers. And the other thing is that the notice requirement for the planned dates of taking the leave has also been reduced to 28 days. So those things will need to be reflected in your paternity leave policies. I think just one thing to note on this is that under the statutory scheme, at least, employees will still lose their right to paternity leave if they take shared parental leave before they take their paternity leave, which of course might be the case if you wanted to just take 1 week at the time of birth and then you saved up your second week for later. You would lose that under the statutory scheme if you've already gone on to shared parental leave. Again, of course, employers might choose to provide a more generous entitlement and not enforce that.
Okay. Might also be worth flagging here the recent EAT case of Hilton Foods and Right, which made clear that the protection against dismissal or detriment for seeking to take family-related leave can apply even before the employee has formally submitted a notice applying for that leave. So in that case, the employee had simply taken initial steps indicating an intention to take parental leave when he was having his discussions with HR and his line manager, but could nevertheless bring that claim of automatic unfair dismissal for seeking to take the leave. So plenty there for HR teams to look at in terms of updating policies and training managers. I think we're out of time for today. Anna, thanks so very much for taking us through these changes. There's more information on the changes on our blog, including an HR checklist, which summarises what we've discussed today. So please do subscribe if you haven't already. So until next time, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.